Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today, we are going to look at just one song, the 1968 song Revolution, which is a track that spins off in a couple of different directions as it takes shape throughout the summer of 1968. And it's an interesting one, isn't it, Stephen? It kind of comes at a busy time professionally for them.
It is. They've come back from their trip to India. They're launching Apple. Paul and John have had their May press conference in America announcing that. I think the public are interested to see what's happening. This form of Western communism that they're touting. They're starting to solicit contributions and tapes and scripts and from various people. And plus, they have to get round to the business of recording the new album.
Yeah, they've had a number one while they've been in India with Lady Madonna, and people are still wanting them to get back into the studio. And so there's a couple of things we need to think about when we think about the song Revolution. And probably the first thing to look at, and we should state for the record, we are not historians in the broadest sense, but there is a context of activity in 1968. There's an environment that this song is being written in and that it comes out to. That is, I suppose, not unlike some of the chaotic times that we're seeing in 2020, but people are waiting for a statement. And so there's a lot in 68 that people need to keep in the back of their mind, isn't there?
There is. And I mean, it's perhaps difficult at this remove from 1968 to appreciate just how seriously the sort of fear was of, you know, insurrection, rebellion, revolution, that there was a sense of that the order, the existing order, was under threat. And you have America embroiled in the war in Vietnam. In January, the Viet Cong had launched the Tet Offensive, which was a sort of push back against American forces. And I think this is the point at which certainly the American government and the American people start to think, we are not going to win this war. This war is not capable of being won. In February 68, the government in the States announced 543 U.S. soldiers had been killed in a single week, which was the highest death toll. The war, it's an election year, and the war is the big issue.
The American election, I mean, you know, the song Revolution, you know, gets put down in May and June. But, you know, 1968 as a whole, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff happening on the far side of that as well. There's political assassinations. There's the withdrawal of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who doesn't seek re-election in the American presidential race. There's a chaotic Democratic National Convention that year. There's the Prague Spring out in Eastern Europe. It's a very volatile time.
It is. It's a very tumultuous time. And you've got to remember that this song was written in India. It's recorded in May, June. So you're coming right in the middle of, in April, Martin Luther King has been assassinated. In May, I suppose the big event right across May is the student risings in Paris. It's maybe incorrect to say it's a student rising. I mean, it's social upheaval. Yeah. In France. I mean, at one point, the government, de Gaulle has fled at one point to Germany briefly. The government is about to fall. So all of this is going on around the time is that the song is being recorded. And then, as you say, in the back end of the year, when this song comes out as a B-side of Hey Jude and on the album, those events are still continuing. As you say, in August, the Chicago Democratic Convention. I suppose all of that leads up to Nixon winning the election at the beginning of November.
Yeah.
So it plays out the sort of the composition, the recording, the release, and the public reception is playing out against this background across the whole year. And as you say, you know, everything the Beatles did at that point is being paid attention, and it's are they going to comment? What people are waiting, as you say, they're waiting for a statement.
Yeah, and certainly there's, you know, there's a bit of a you know, we are post-60s people, really. So we've always looked at the 60s through a rear view mirror. And it kind of gets posted as this sort of, you know, oh, there's a man looking at a military jacket in Carnaby Street type thing.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And, you know, it was swinging and it was fantastic. But I think, you know, the 60s in the United States meant something very different to the 60s in London, and London meant something very different to the rest of the UK. But it's interesting how globally there's a lot of unrest in 68, that it all kind of tips over, and it's something that isn't as well known as the kind of the jolly swinging part of the 60s, you could say sometimes.
No, I think that's right. And I think we touched on this on an episode last season, which is this shift from swinging London to America, and particularly the West Coast. And that's a much more, you know, it's much more aggressive music. It's the music of protest. It's hard rock. And yes, I think London, you know, the UK is not directly involved in the war in Vietnam. I suppose the big event in 68 in London is the 100,000 people marching on the American embassy, Grosvenor Square, in March.
Yeah.
But that is a sort of statement of solidarity with protests in America. But then everyone the next day can get up and go about their business and go back to college and go back to their job. And so America is really the center of that protest movement. And in Europe, it's really France is the protest. But these protests are breaking out all across the Western world.
And what's different then to now is, at that point, the pop culture, there was this notion of, oh, actually, there's this voice of a generation thing that certain people have. And people are looking to see, you know, well, you know, what will Dylan say? What will the Beatles say? What will X, Y, and Z say? And you talk about the March 1968 protest at the American Embassy in London, which had 100,000 protesters. But that maybe should let us segue into somebody else who was a voice of the generation at the time and who was involved or who was at those protests, which was Mick Jagger.
Yes.
And we might talk a little bit about the Stones and Street Fighting Man, because Jagger was there in March 68 and that kind of influenced him, didn't it?
Yes, I'm always quite skeptical about Jagger. You know, he's a bit of a chameleon, and he sort of skirts around, you know, plays with fire. The sort of the danger of student demonstration. There's the politics. He still does this today. He sort of dips in and out of political statements with lyrics that he writes, but certainly the descriptions of him there are, you know, that he was linking arms with the students, and then suddenly he is recognized and he becomes the focus, and the press are trying to get an interview with him. He's on camera, and he sort of realizes that his fame isn't, you know, it's not going to allow him to be a leader in this circumstances. His fame is a distraction, but nevertheless, this is something that whether he feels genuinely moved by the cause, or whether he thinks this is a good vehicle for a song, this is a good subject matter for a song, but he repurposes an existing track lyrically and comes up with Street Fighting Man, and this is sort of in parallel with what Lennon is doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, I know 5% as much about the Stones as I do about the Beatles, and I can blow a bit hot and cold on them, but Street Fighting Man would be one of my favorite Stones tracks. And as you say, it's interesting. It begins life as this song called Did Everyone Pay Their Dues, which is a very dull, prosaic type title, you know?
Yeah.
And that line is the line, you know, what can a poor boy do? That was originally, did everyone pay their dues? Which is kind of not very rock and roll in a way, you know?
It's not saying much. It's not saying much.
That's available on YouTube.
Yes, what I like about this about Street Fighting Man is it's sort of the template for what carries the Stones through the next three or four albums. That sort of scrubbed acoustic guitars, with layering on top of it of electric guitars, and that's the kind of and with piano as well, and it's that Beggar's Banquet sound that kind of carries them through, and I love that.
Yeah, they really flipped a switch in 68, because you think of 67, you have Sergeant Pepper, and then 6 months later, Satanic Majesties. You know, there's this kind of carbon copy, Stones in the Shadow type thing that John and Paul would bitch about at the time and later, you know?
Constantly,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, that the Stones were kind of copying them. And in 68, you know, Jimmy Miller starts producing them and, you know, they do Honky Tonk Women and they do Street Fighting Man and they kind of pull away into the Stones we kind of know today. And whether Street Fighting Man is cynical or not, it certainly has a great sound. And you could argue that, you know, the Stones, they're not necessarily setting the template for writing a song about revolution, but they are ahead of the curve a little bit in terms of fashioning this song, because they write it in March, they record it in April, May. They're, you know, it doesn't really come out till later in the summer, so we don't really know whether it was in the Beatles' eye line at all.
Yeah.
But they are certainly getting better at defining themselves and sticking their finger up to the wind and seeing which way it's going.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You know, the Stones have that harder edge sound, and that's what 68 is all about. You know, you've got Hendrix, you've got Cream, you've got those West Coast bands. There's a shift in the sound of what popular music is, what popular music should be doing. And I suppose, and we maybe come on to this when we look at the sort of critical reaction and response, the way that Revolution is received, there's a slight notion at this stage. You know, the Beatles are identified with Sgt. Pepper, 1967, The Summer of Love, All You Need Is Love. It's all sort of peace and flowers and looking for jackets in Carnaby Street. But 1968 is not about that. It's completely different. There's been a complete sea change in sort of youth culture, if that term existed at the time. The generation gap has suddenly just completely widened. The Beatles, I think, again, this is one of my pet theories, is that the Beatles were responsible in a way for keeping that gap closed.
Yeah.
Because everybody could like the Beatles, you know, the kids and the grannies and the mums and the dads and the politicians, and could see the benefit. But 1968, all that is cast aside, and perhaps that Summer of Love is, you know, just a memory by the time you get to Summer of 68.
Yeah. And so they come back from India with a bunch of songs, our Beatle friends. And Revolution is one of these songs fashioned up in the hills of India. And it's not really, you know, for a song about revolution, you know, India's a pretty peaceful place, you know?
Yeah. Lennon made a comment about this in his Jan Wenner interview in 1970, and he said, you know, I'd been thinking about this up in the hills in India. I still had this God will save us all feeling, everything's going to be all right. I wanted to talk, I wanted to say my piece about the revolution, but, you know, everything's going to be okay. So he's writing it from that that standpoint, that at the end, you know, he knows times are hard, there is a revolution coming, but it's going to be all right. And it's essentially a positive message.
Yeah. And so we get to this question, or this point in time, where it's like, well, we need a new Beatle record. We need to get recording. And, you know, the 30th of May is when Revolution becomes the first song recorded for what eventually becomes the White Album. But we need to rewind a little bit, because there's a little bit of work before that. And May, as we have said, is busy. And what's interesting is they had block booked Abbey Road from the 20th of May onwards, but they don't use that first week at all. And they're due to be in there every day, 2 till midnight. It gets booked from the end of May to the end of July. But famously, we know what happens first is the Esher demos happen.
Yes. You wonder why, if they had Abbey Road booked, they didn't do the demo, the rehearsals and the demos.
Yeah, they had it booked that time. It's very strange.
In the studio, but instead, you know, they head out to George's house. And this is really the first time, I think, that they've done this sort of pre-production work. You know, sometimes they'll go into the studio and they'll sketch something out and they'll do rehearsal and they'll wipe those tapes and then they'll go for a take. But here they're actually sitting around playing these numbers as a block of songs.
But really, if you think about it, they had worked so much on the hoof for the previous 5.5 years. And it's worth reminding ourselves it's 5.5 years since Love Me Do, that they never really probably had more than 2 or 3 songs ready to go at any point
ready
in time.
Ready to go at any one time.
Would have had whatever it was. How many ended up on the Escher demos tape? 30 odd songs.
Yeah.
You know, they just didn't have them before, so it did make sense to just write down these very brief sketches. And I suppose we don't really know that the recording order of the Escher demos. Sure, we don't.
No. I mean, I've always just perhaps naively assumed it's as they come, as you hear them on the tape. But
we're not sure.
We're not sure, but they're clearly sketching out the arrangements, and it's clear here that John has a very fixed idea of what this song is going to be like, and it's pretty much all there except for the final, that Chairman Mao verse.
And you know, the Escher demos are now part of the expanded 2018 White Album, so it's on the 3 CD and the full box set version. And you know, the demo is it's infectious. You know, it's great.
It is. I mean, you can see the merit in the song straight away. I mean, this is not something that you think he's going to have to take in, which is very often the case with John songs, that he takes something in and then, you know, Paul sprinkles his fairy dust on it and it becomes kind of sweeter, or this is all there and it's immediately infectious. It's a pretty simple sort of shuffle arrangement.
Yeah. And something I'll probably touch on again, because it kind of feels like the first solo Lennon song. You know, you listen to that demo and it's infectious. It sounds like a different thing. He's not necessarily doing a Bob Dylan kind of vibe. He's not necessarily doing a Mr. Kite, you know, fun Beatles kind of vibe.
Yeah.
It's certainly not a love song. It really is him trying to speak as him to get something across, but yet still you can still dance to it, you know.
Yes, I mean, I think this is what he was sort of saying. He wanted to speak about the war. He was fed up with the Beatles being constrained. Epstein's no longer around, so there is that sense of freedom. And yes, this is maybe at that point the most personal song that he's committed, at least the most openly personal. You know, we've had songs where he's writing about his own experiences before, but they've been sort of hidden or under arrangements, or they've been, you know, Help has been speeded up to make it a catchy mop top single. But here is, yeah, this is maybe the template for what comes later around 1970 Plastic Ono Band, that sort of feeling.
And so the demo has John on acoustic guitar and he's singing. The others are clapping and occasionally joining in, and John double tracks some of his guitar and vocals on the demo as well. And so is there something in that, in this, the official Escher demo CD, have they tinkered with the Revolution demo?
They have. What they've done is they've fixed the timing. You know, Lennon sort of famously was sort of wayward in his sense of time and timekeeping. And, you know, he would stretch, put in extra bars and extra beats and things like that. But the timing sort of is off. If you hear the original tape, and what they've done is they've fixed it through sort of digital trickery so that it is all in the same tempo. I'm not sure. I was going to say I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I know exactly how I feel about that. I don't like it. I think, well, you know, if I'm
you'll have to go along with it, Stephen. Your DNA.
I don't like it, but I'll have to go along with it. It's, you know, why do you need to fix this? They were sitting, you know, round a tape recorder in George's living room, presumably. And why not just let us hear? No one's expecting this to be studio perfect.
Well, I mean, you told me this and I didn't notice, and I went back and I listened to the official release again and I still don't really notice. So why are they doing it? I totally understand why you don't like it. And I can understand why it would be something that would not be liked. However,
because I'm a cantankerous old man.
That's not what I'm saying. That's what I'm implying. But at the same time, you know, I like this notion of what are these boxes trying to do? And this is not Bob Dylan bootleg volume 12. This is the Beatles still trying to entertain Mac Chow a little bit, you know, put out something that everyone's going to like, including the musos and the casual buyers who might only buy one box set a year. You know, I think.
So you're saying that this is all Paul's doing?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And so therefore it's a good idea.
I suppose it's that tension between presenting an historical artifact,
yes,
or a piece of entertainment. And my view is, well, we've got the piece of entertainment in the sort of polished
the album itself,
up album itself.
Yeah.
So give us the unadulterated original. You know, but I'm joking about saying this is Paul, but Paul is notorious for doing this in his own box set. Mm. So he will take a song that was recorded in 1972, and before he puts it in the box set, he'll just add a little kind of bass riff, or he'll polish it up, or he'll get it remixed. And I think that's not one thing, and it's not another. It's a kind of Frankenstein.
It's like the Stones did it on Sticky Fingers. There's new Lennon vocals on, or new Jagger vocals on the Sticky Fingers box set from a few years back, isn't there? Which is all a bit strange.
Although those are very good, I have to say. anyway.
That's for the, whatever the Rolling Stones podcast is called.
Stones podcast, yeah. Coming soon.
So, you know, we're going to get to the big day itself, which is May the 30th, which is the first recording studio day for the White Album, and the song that they're going for is John's Revolution. And John obviously thinks highly of the song. The band think highly of the song. There's this question of it might be a single.
Yeah, might be the new single. Certainly, John, after the event, would have said that.
Yeah, and I like this notion of that, you know, the first song of the album is a John song, that it sets the template, and it follows a pattern that the first song they recorded for Revolver was Tomorrow Never Knows. The first song they recorded for Sgt. Pepper was Strawberry Fields. And, you know, John comes in and he sort of sets the, is it a roadmap or a template or a vibe? He sort of lays down the card or the gauntlet for what's about to happen.
And do you think he's insisting on that? Or do you think the others are just sort of saying, well, we've got to indulge, you know, there is form where you sort of indulge John and let him do his thing.
I don't think it's indulging.
To keep him happy.
I think, you know, in deference to Paul, you know, Paul recognized, you know, John's greatness and loved, and I don't think anything made Paul happier. I can't think of any instance where Paul undermined a John song, really. You know, and I think he would have been more than happy to, you know, and what we'll see is actually it takes a while for Paul to get his feet under the desk of making the White Album. But I don't think Paul would have done that with any kind of, you know, biting his lip or anything. I certainly think, though, that there's stuff happening on that day that is different for all of them, because maybe we should talk about the Yoko in the room.
Yes. Well, you know, they're all there. All the key members of the Beatles are there. John, Paul, Ringo and Yoko.
Yes. There's no George, we don't think.
There's no George. He's not prepared to indulge John.
But that's setting ourselves up for the January 69 John, Paul, Ringo, Yoko session. Whole lot of Yoko, which we all like. But it is interesting that, you know, it sort of has to be explained to the band, as Ringo comically says years later, you know, we go home and tell our wives what we did. And John said, well, I'm just going to have her here all the time. And
John says this, and this I find intriguing, is that John said later he had to get permission.
John had to get permission?
Yeah, he
from
said,
who?
Well, presumably from the other Beatles.
Hmm. I give that a big hum. I don't know about that.
I don't know about that either. But that's, you know, but here we are, day one, first time back in the studio since mid-February, pre-India. Yoko's there.
Yeah.
I don't know. She's sitting on an amp. Maybe she's sitting on George's amp.
sitting on George's
not
biscuits.
There. Yeah.
And it's a whole new world. And I think, you know, they're setting sail on Revolution because it is a great song, you know, and it's you know, the analogy I've used before, Stephen, is that it's like Stevie Nicks' songs in Fleetwood Mac, you know, that, that maybe Lindsay is the overbearing, hyper-talented one, but Stevie is the one that's got the emotional map for what's going on, you know?
What's going on. Okay.
So Stevie's John Lennon and Lindsay is Paul in that analogy.
We come back to that. Okay.
That's for our third podcast.
Yeah.
The Thunder Only Happens When It's Raining podcast. Anyway, so you talk about the usual players being there, but the other players are kind of around as well, which is George Martin, Jeff Emmerich, who's starting to get a bit of the collie wobbles.
Yes. One of the sources of one of the books that I read doing a bit of research for this is his Here, There and Everywhere book. And I think I've made my feelings clear previously about this book. It's so biased against George in particular, so dismissive of Ringo that I sort of have lost faith in his objectivity, but he does give a very detailed description of this first day. And he does record the fact that he says Paul seemed unusually subdued that night. Perhaps he was annoyed that John was dominating the proceedings so much. My own take on that might be that Yoko was there.
Yeah.
Because that's a new factor and just changes the dynamic.
Yeah.
Emmerich also recounts an argument that he had with John, where John is he asked John to turn his guitar down, or points out that it's sort of it's distorting, and there's a bit of a set two here about this. Emmerich says George Martin would not go down onto the studio floor and speak to Lennon about this, but sent him down.
Yeah,
and Lennon was saying, no, I want this to be overdriven. Now this is an acoustic guitar he's playing, but he's got everything turned up, and Emmerich then has to go and fix to get that distorted sound.
Yeah.
And he said he uses the same technique as he did by pushing a preamp up that he did on the vocal for I Am the Walrus.
Just as a side point, years ago, I used to play around with a little 4-track tape machine, and I did not have an electric guitar at the time. And it is a fun thing to do. You just totally overload your tape machine to make your electric sound like an acoustic. It's certainly... totally blasts out.
Well, again, the other parallel is this is what the Stones are doing.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere far away in another part of town, they are doing the same thing with acoustic guitars and little toy drum kits, setting up the bedrock for Street Fighting Man. So it's interesting that they're both working in a similar fashion.
And as a side point, it's also interesting, Chris Thomas is also there as George Martin's assistant. That's his first day on the job. He's 21 years old. And Chris Thomas goes on to, well, he's working in the Beatle universe in these last few years, but he goes on to, you know, work with the Sex Pistols and a whole bunch of people and produce Back to the Egg, which is in 1979. So he's learning the skill of producing, and that's a pretty amazing first Beatles session. So they go through a number of recordings of the song on May 30th. And as we said, you know, George doesn't seem to be there, and it's John, Paul and Ringo, and it's John on acoustic, Ringo on drums, obviously Paul on a piano.
Yeah.
And they work up to 18 takes. And again, what we were saying a few minutes ago, this is kind of Plastic Ono Band stuff, really. It's just, a tight trio getting into the groove, the very core nugget of the song, in a way.
Yeah, sort of this stripped back, acoustic guitar, distorted. It's very like Plastic Ono Band.
Yeah, and we're lucky now that we get to hear the final take, which is take 18, which is now the opening track of the first disc of studio outtakes on the Beatles White Album box set. And if you're coming to, because it's that take 18 that we probably need to focus in on, because that's what becomes not only Revolution 1, but it also gets hived off in part to form Revolution 9.
Yes.
And at this point, Revolution 1 is actually just called Revolution, because we don't...
It's all there is.
Well, it's all there is. And that's really interesting as well, that it's the 30th of May, they're bringing in this song, and... You know, as a self-contained song, you can hear on the demo, it's a great song, but it's actually going to become three totally different things. And that's not obvious on day one. That's not part of the plan at all.
No.
And it's echoes of the whole Strawberry Fields Forever situation, where John brings in a new song and they're cutting version after version of it, and it turns into different things. And they're all worthy things.
Yes. Yes. I mean, this idea of them just jamming at the end of a particular take, they've never, I think, before done anything with that. They'll do it again in the future. So the early takes of something have John vamping away on the piano, a rather sort of odd coda to that song that he then takes and uses on Plastic Ono Band. But yes, they can have it does intrigue me as to whether or not John had the idea that this entire sort of 10-minute take would be the finished article, because Yoko is present. She just happens to have a tape with her that she plays.
So what's she doing? She has a tape recorder in her hands or something, isn't it? And she's playing loops of speech or something.
Yeah, she seems to have come in with presumably a tape that she has made up of loops and recitations and sound effects and things like that. And certainly Mark Lewison says, you know, take 14, you suddenly get the first appearance of this tape playing in the background. Hmm. So there's this notion of random sounds, or now this is something that they've done on Tomorrow Never Knows, obviously themselves, where they had constructed
the radio. Well,
yeah. So she's in there, she's got a tape, and this starts to be heard.
Yeah.
So the take 18, you get these coming again. Paul is vamping on the piano. He starts doing the shooby-doo-wop vocals. Yep. You get that phrase, maybe if you become naked.
Yes.
Which then crops up. So this makes it, that phrase is making its first appearance on this tape that Yoko is bringing into the studio.
And so it's interesting, because if you're listening to it, you might think, oh, it's just Yoko talking in the background, but it's not. It's Yoko manipulating a tape of her talking, and the tape is going into its own microphone, basically.
Yes,
its own,
yes.
So it's just being picked up by some microphone.
Yeah. And then the jam is sort of continuing over the top of that and becomes this other thing. And, you know, you wonder, did she have, was this prearranged? Did John sit down and say, hey guys, you know, Yoko's got this tape, she's going to play, or did this just happen spontaneously? That's the fly on the wall situation. You'd like to see how that developed and what.
And this final take 18, if you actually go to the Lewison Sessions book, he sort of says that take 18 is different. It's not like they did 17 takes like this.
No.
This take 18 has, you know, the first 3 to 4 minutes of song, and then this back end 6 minutes of very, very different vamping. And as I said, we can hear it on the box set now or on your streaming services of choice. And what's interesting is that John is either consciously or subconsciously, he's vocalizing in a way that you could say is Yoko-like, you know, where he's trying to get through, you know, get kind of a scream or a noise or sort of, you know, that kind of ululating that Yoko sometimes is known for or mocked for. And he's reaching up into that with the groans and the squawks and all the rest.
Yes. So this is so the first, this is their first day back. This is their first song that they're recording. And suddenly they're off in this completely different direction. Yoko's right in the middle, and she's participating not just sort of, you know,
passively,
or, you know, they brought people in before to do backing vocals or people who've been in the studio, but suddenly she is actively participating and driving or steering this song in a particular direction.
That must have been
quite a shock.
And you listen to that 10-minute take 18, and you kind of get this feeling, you know, once you get into minute 5 and minute 6, that, you know, everyone's like, oh, this is a good idea. Whatever's happening, this hasn't happened before. Let's keep doing this. And it's you know, Ringo, you know, he is the tick. Or he, what is it? He says, I am the click. Ringo is being the click, and it's just, he's keeping it locked down. And again, it's just three instruments. Although on that take 18, you hear a bit of an organ noise at the end. I'm not sure where that's coming from. And it's great. It's organized chaos, but it's capturing a moment.
It is. As I say, it must have been shocking. I imagine that it heads off in that direction, but to everyone's credit, they stick with it. They kind of grab it and they go with it. And, you know, no one, I suppose any of them at any time could just have said, right, that's it, or called a halt. But they do. They could, obviously, there is something there. I have to say, I do really enjoy take 18. I do really like.
Yeah, John sounds happy. He sounds happy as he gets through it, and But this is the bedrock for what becomes Revolution 1, Revolution 9, as we said. And when you listen to the Take 18, especially when John is singing the right that we know later on Revolution 9, it's really striking to hear it in context. And I think it makes, as we'll talk about later on, it gives Revolution 9 almost makes a lot more sense when you hear it in this.
It does. I mean, it really, really does. Revolution 9, if you hear that out of context, it's just a crazy chaotic thing. But here you can actually see the foundation that it's built on. And just to go back to that point where you were saying John sounds happy, perhaps that's what Paul is responding to.
Yeah.
You know, because he's vamping away on the piano and then he starts the kind of 50s shooby-doo-wop backing vocal. So he's actively participating and entering into the spirit of the thing.
But it's great because that kind of moment where Paul is doing shooby-doo-wop, you know, sometimes Paul gets, you know, knocked down for, you know, doing kind of cheesy things, honey pie and all that kind of stuff. You gave me the answer and all the rest. But, you know, it takes a moment like that in a John song and that John will, you know, incorporate it into the song. And that's where it all works brilliantly. And I can't imagine Paul wasn't anything but happy working on that that session.
I think that does come across. And it's interesting that you know Emmerich says Paul was very subdued, but he doesn't really sort of deal with the sort of apparent joy or enthusiasm that then emerges.
But he's in a recording studio making music, so listen, that's better than being in an Apple meeting for So it's a long day. It's a roughly a 12-hour session. The official papers say 2:30 p.m. to 2:40 a.m. doing Revolution. And then they are back in studio the next day, Friday, the 31st of May. Again, they've blocked booked the studio from 2:30 to midnight through to the end of July. They're back in on Friday, the 31st of May. George is in tow as well. But John and Yoko were busy that morning. They were house hunting.
Yes,
is that right?
They were out house hunting. So at one point, you know, I can't repeat the language, but John said he would be prepared to live in a tent. If he was with Yoko, but then clearly decided, well, perhaps a house would be better.
very large house.
So this is, they're out earlier in the day with Pete Shotton looking for a house, which ultimately would lead them to Tittenhurst.
Yeah, the famous Tittenhurst.
And
May the 31st, the following day, they're in the smaller Studio 3. And John is working on vocals. Paul is putting on a bass. And Paul and George are putting on the official kind of shooby-doo-wop backing vocals. And it's, you know, they are building on this Take 18.
Yes. And the interesting point here is about the lyrics. So they're adding, you know, John is doing the lead vocals and he's still refining the lyric. There's an engineer, Alan Brown, who was there and he was saying, you know, he was in the control room of Studio 3 and then suddenly, you know, in the darkness of the studio, going over and over the lines of the song is John Lennon. He said he's going through the song and every time he's changing a word or two about you can count me out, you can count me in. So that's, he's still at this point, clearly has decided, count me out, count me in. He hasn't come to a definitive response.
But he is going to, we know which way he comes down, but that's with the next vocal session, I think, where he makes that one. So that's Friday, the 31st of May. And then they have a few days off and they're back in studio on Tuesday, the 4th of June. And they are still working on the first song from the White Album, which is Revolution, which is still called Revolution. It's Revolution 1. And this is another kind of crazy day in EMI Studio 3.
Yes,
it's their days are quite packed.
They are. And I mean, before we actually get into the studio, if I can mention, this is the day that supposedly John and Paul earlier in the day meet Italian film director Franco Zeffirelli.
Yes. And this is on Paul's behalf or something, isn't it?
Yes. And I'm not quite sure why John would be there, but supposedly Franco
was there. Maybe, I suppose she was.
Well, Zeffirelli supposedly offers Paul the role of Romeo. Of course, perhaps Yoko was going to be Juliet.
Unlikely.
In Romeo and Juliet, which was a hugely successful film by Zeffirelli, comes out later in 1968. And Paul talks about this, and the actress who ultimately played Juliet Olivia Hussey has talked about this, and she describes being out at a nightclub with Paul, and Paul squiring her around the night spots of London. And Paul has talked about this as well, but he very diplomatically says, "Oh yes, I was out with Olivia Hussey. This is long before I met Linda."
Well, that doesn't add up. A good lawyer would shoot holes in that.
Well, I think he's just being diplomatic there. But can I give you my top trivia points?
Yes, go on. This is about the Romeo and Juliet film.
Yes, the actor who did get you love these trivia points.
I love the trivia.
There's a monkeys reference. You'll enjoy that. The actor who got the part was Leonard Whiting, and he was most famous for having replaced Davy Jones in the cast of Oliver, which allowed Davy and the rest of the cast to go off to Broadway and appear on the Ed Sullivan Show at the same time as the Beatles.
Yes, Davy Jones from the Monkees was on that first Ed Sullivan Show with the Beatles. It's strange but true. Did he have any other significant career? Do we know him?
Oh, I see where you're going. As an actor, no, but he sang lead vocals on a song called The Raven, which I don't know.
Yes.
On the first Alan Parsons project.
The Alan Parsons project, yes.
I can say I have never knowingly heard a song by the Alan Parsons project.
Another side point, I would say I went through a streaming overview of Alan Parsons Project, and the album that's worth getting is iRobot. That's a top record.
Okay.
I never really plugged into the rest of them, but iRobot is a synthesizer-tastic album of madness. But they are in the studio working on more things to do with Revolution. And I may be inspired by Yoko being there. Paul brings someone to the studio.
Yes, Paul brings his new girlfriend, Francie Schwartz, to the studio.
Francie Schwartz. Now, she's one of these names that pops up in Beatle lore. There's a very small window where she appears. It's this kind of middle of, right bang splat in the middle of 68.
Yes, so there's a lot going on in Paul's love life in 68. But she seems to have been, or she would say she was a very serious girlfriend. Mm. She began her relationship with Paul, she says, at the same time that he was engaged to Jane Asher.
Yeah.
And Jane discovering Paul and Francie Schwartz together was really the cause of the end of that relationship, that engagement. Francie Schwartz had gone to London to pitch one of her scripts to Apple, supposedly. And then Paul took her back to his place to show her his
Magritte. Yeah.
I'm going to have to get some Magritte. She is around all through the summer. She is there living effectively in Cavendish Avenue with Paul at the time that John and Yoko move in.
Yeah.
She is present in July on the Mad Day Out, where they have that very famous sort of photo session.
She chooses the locations, doesn't she? Or she's involved
She's involved in that. She takes some pictures. I always imagine that is sort of Don McCullen and Tom Murray and the Beatles, but there's a whole entourage there. Mm. Yoko's there. Francie Schwartz is there. So there's a sense at this stage, I think, that Paul is sort of elevating her to the same status as Yoko, you know.
Yeah,
she's my girlfriend, so I'm going to bring her. She wrote a book. Have you read that book?
I, of course, have not read the book.
The book is called Body Count.
Okay.
It was written in 1972. It mm-hmm. is a truly awful book.
Why is it awful?
It's just, it's the most overwritten, flowery prose. And let me tell you, there is no detail of their relationship that she's not prepared to elaborate on.
Oh dear.
So it's a very, very difficult book to find, and I can only imagine that Paul bought and burned every copy he could get his hands on. I do not recommend it. I have a copy of it on PDF that somebody very kindly sent me. A listener on this podcast sent me the book. It's a terrible, terrible book.
And she also, this, what's interesting about the whole White Album thing is there's very little documentary evidence of what's going on, but there is a bit of film footage of the Blackbird recording, and she's in that somewhere, isn't she? She's knocking around in the background.
She is. So you can see her on that promotional film. She does sing some backing vocals on that come through on takes of Revolution 9. Yeah. So suddenly, but you know, everyone's in the studio. Patty Harrison is singing on Birthday. Yeah. Yoko's there. I think Maureen is singing backing vocals. So suddenly it's maybe, you know, John bringing Yoko has made it okay to bring the wives in.
By the way, do we know where Francis Schwartz is today?
No. I don't know. And, you know,
hanging out with Jimmy Nichol. Probably
hanging out with Jimmy Nichol. I don't know.
So
someone will know. Someone will tell us.
Maybe she's listening. Hi there. So on this day in the studio, again, full tilt, June 4th, they're working on Revolution. And what they do is they start adding to this take 18 that they've done the previous week. And this gets called take 20. And
yes.
This is actually a bootleg that you can look up on YouTube and the like. And it's interesting because, John knows he's doing something, but he's not sure what he's doing. And there's lots of things going on. First of all, he's redoing his vocal.
Yes.
And this is famously, there's a picture in Lewis and Studio Sessions book. He always wanting his vocal to sound different, he decides he's going to lie flat on his back and sing into a microphone suspended above his head. Because, you know, why not?
Why not?
And
why
not? So he puts down his lead vocal for Revolution. So I think this is where he puts down, "You can count me out, count me in." That's where
this arrives at this point, yeah.
And it's important for the record, Your Honor, that the first finalized version of the Revolution/Revolution 1 lyric is, "When you talk about destruction, don't you know you can count me out in?" It's the first one he records, but that's important later on because that's not the first one that people hear. And they're also gathering around the mic, and what are they doing? They're doing tape loops and backing vocals and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yes, it reminds me of some of the descriptions you get of, you know, the Beach Boys sessions for Smile, where people are kind of crunching gravel and setting off fire alarms and crunching vegetables, and it's just crazy stuff going on. And this is the take that begins with John saying, "Take your knickers off and let's go," in one of his sort of comedy goon voices. I hadn't heard this until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and it suddenly appeared on YouTube, I think was the first. And it's fantastic. I love this take, this mix.
It's you wonder, maybe it escaped at the time of the assembly for the 2018 box. It's not on the 2018 box, obviously.
It's a source of great irritation to me. There are many things irritate me, but but this irritates me.
Well, I think I can understand why. I think, you know, I think they probably came down to a choice between the original unadorned take 18 or this kind of overdub remix take 20. And I think take 18 is better to hear it in its skeletal form. Take 20 is a different version of the same thing. So I don't think they could have put both on. Again, they're not doing the Bob Dylan, "Let's include everything for historical accuracy" type situation.
Yeah, but why could they not put, you know, you've got the Isher demo.
I know.
You've got an early take, you've got 18, you've got 20, and then you've got the sort of finished songs. I mean, what I'm interested in, and this is probably the song that shows it more than any other, is that evolution.
Yes,
of the sound picture and that sort of hiving off. And I look forward to the 60th anniversary box set where all of these, including take 20,
will appear.
Available.
Yeah, they're doing vocals, backing vocals. They're doing tape loops again. There's part of it that sounds a bit, you know, a bit repetitive in terms of there's a bit of a Tomorrow Never Knows vibe going on.
Yeah.
There's two very sort of loud tape loops that come in and out of it that sound very much alike. The Beatles going, ah, and a big kind of guitar note.
Yeah.
And it's kind of got a screeching thing that reminded me a bit like Armenia City in the Sky from The Who Sell Out, you know?
Yes.
Kind of got that kind of dronal noise that just kind of fades in and out over and over again. So I think I could see why they'd get to the end of the recording session and go, you know, this isn't...
Maybe not too much.
This hasn't cracked a nut. Like, when we did take 18, we were onto something new. This isn't what to do next with this. I could see why they might think that. But it's around about this point that what does happen is that this Revolution 1 recording gets hived off into Revolution 1 and Revolution 9.
Yes.
And so this back end, this last 6 minutes of this take gets taken away. And it's, you know, that's Tuesday the 4th of June, they're doing all these tape loops. Wednesday the 5th of June, they work on Don't Pass Me By. And it's on Thursday the 6th of June that they start to assemble a different thing, which is Revolution 9. And we're going to focus on Revolution 9 in part two of this Revolution talk. But that's where this division happens after this 4th of June session. So if we stay on the Revolution 1 track for a moment, this kind of gets, you know, put aside for a few weeks. They start to arrange stuff. The next focused session on that is June 21st.
That's right.
And that's right. Just John and George at this point, isn't it?
This is John and George sort of putting the finishing touches. So Paul is in America at this point, at the Beverly Hills Hilton, addressing the Capital Sales Convention. So he's effectively over there announcing that all of the Apple records will be distributed by Capitol. He's playing a little promotional tape, the Blackbird session that you talked about earlier. He plays that film and is generally sort of glad-handing and doing the PR stuff. John and George are back in the studio overdubbing brass. So there's that sort of brass arrangement, two trumpets, four trombones. George Martin has written the score there. They make two attempts at that, and they turn take 20 effectively into take 22, onto which George plays his lead guitar.
Electric guitar riff at the start.
Yeah.
And that lead electric guitar riff, you know, whether that's the seed that leads us to the re-recording of Revolution,
it certainly
would seem to be the stepping stone, that noise. That's kind of, you know, you can see the DNA that gets you from that point to the re-recording of.
That's the fascinating thing to me about this song in particular, is you can, it's that exactly it. It's that DNA. So you've got these various strands, and the other intriguing thing is the choices they make. You know, I'm not sure in any of the re-releases, certainly, you know, Anthology and the box sets, that you could ever say they didn't make the right choice.
Yes.
In terms of the take or the arrangement or the part. But this is the song that sort of spawns the most diverse sort of iterations.
Yes. And so this is on June the 21st, and they probably think that they're finished the song. They end the session by doing a load of stereo mixes for it, just John and George. And what's interesting at this point is that, you know, this is June 21st. It started on May 30th. The only song that Paul has put down in this stage is Blackbird, which he puts down.
Yes.
There's one session where John is in the room on the 11th of June, where he just goes over and over and over again trying to nail down Blackbird, which is one of the more fun bootleg things you can listen to, is all 30 odd takes of Blackbird.
Well, it is, but and John making suggestions from the control room that Paul is studiously ignoring.
But Paul still hasn't done a band recording for the White Album. We're almost a month into recording. It's really interesting. And so on the 21st of June, they think they do these stereo mixes. They believe that they're finished. There's a little bit of Revolution 9 work going on in the background as well. And then, you know, they're out of the studio for the whole weekend. But there's an interesting, crazy thing that happens over the weekend.
So bear in mind, of these various stereo mixes made on the 21st, John must have taken an acetate of this home. So on the 22nd, which is the Saturday, John and Yoko fly from Luton to Shannon in Ireland by jet, and then they take a helicopter to the island of Dornish, somewhere in the west, I believe.
West coast of Ireland, yes, wherever that is.
This is an in joke. This is an island that John had bought in May 1967 for £1,500. I always thought this was just one of his crazy acid filled fueled notions. Wouldn't it be nice to have an island somewhere? And I wasn't sure what he was actually going to do with it. But I was reading that Chip Mettinger book Lennonology, and he says that he actually had commissioned a firm of architects, Hildebrand and Glicker Architects, to design an absolute state-of-the-art recording facility. So as far away from the rest of Europe as you can get without being in America, that's the place to build a recording studio. And it was going to be called Irish Mythical Studios.
Right.
So there you go.
It is odd, though, that, you know, he has to summon the architects and summon the design as if the studio is going to make the stuff. If you just compare that to Paul going up to Mull of Kintyre.
Yes, yes.
Where it's just like, actually,
here's a barn.
Here's a barn. Here's a tape recorder. Let's see what we can get on with. It's curious.
You wonder, did he really have in mind, you know, something like the Apple Studio, that third parties would come and use it? And
I think, I don't know.
Maybe it was just an acid-fueled notion.
Yeah, but also, you know, if you want to get deep and personal, you know, we all sort of make deals with ourselves in our head. Mm. If I could just do these things, then that'd be right and happy, and I could, you know, everything would be okay. And so there might have been a bit of that going on, you know. Just,
well, this was May 67 was when he bought the island, so I suppose that was right in the middle of just before Pepper and.
But I'm sure it was a tax dodge anyway.
Could have been. They get to the island.
Yes.
He has the acetate in his hand and he realizes he doesn't have a record player. So doing what any self-respecting millionaire rock star would do, he sends the helicopter back to Westport with Ronan O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce
Ronan
that?
Ronan O'Reilly, yeah.
He was
the founder of Radio Caroline, wasn't he? And he only died earlier in 2020.
Yeah, so John, Yoko, and Pete Shotton stay on the island, and Ronan heads back to Westport with the helicopter to look for a battery-powered turntable, which I'm not sure in Westport in 1968 that would be a particularly common. But he must have found it, because the helicopter gets back to the island, and John has talked about, oh, we played the acetate on the island, and it was glorious, and it was so magical. In the interim, a storm has blown up, and they need to take shelter. So fortunately, John has flown a caravan from the garden in Kenwood to the island. And this is Julian's psychedelic Sergeant Pepper caravan. So, you know, Julian obviously doesn't need it anymore. And it is on the island. And then they all fly off to the Great Southern Hotel at the end of the day.
And they're hanging out with this is the Great Southern Hotel in Mulrani in the west of Ireland. And they're hanging out with there's a bunch. Do they play the record, we think, to the people there? No, or we don't really know.
What seems to happen is they arrive on the evening of the 22nd and, you know, go straight to bed. They get up the next day, go for a visit to Achill Island. And then when they come back, the hotel has very kindly organized a special Irish concert compared by Tony Chambers.
Yes.
The Malloy brothers, Dominic Grady, Mrs. Larry McGovern, and Peggy Jennings, who is the hotel receptionist. They all get up and do a turn.
This is fantastic. Now, I've spoken to my source, the Tony Chambers Band were an act in the region at the time. They are apparently represented in the 1980s Irish film The Ballroom of Romance, which talks about the Irish show band circuit of the 1960s. And the Malloy brothers were an act out of Mayo in Ireland, who were still touring up until the 21st century. So information I got from my dad. Thank you.
There you go. Well, it all sounds very quaint, if I can say that.
And then
suddenly John reciprocates this generosity by cranking the volume up and playing Revolution.
Yeah.
So that must have been quite some end to the evening.
It's quite interesting. The ballroom circuit in Ireland in the 1960s, as a 20-second synopsis, was an alcohol-free circuit of cover version bands that would tour around Ireland and play cover versions of UK and American hits with some original material to crowds of about 2,000 who would jump up and down and dance, mainly in church halls and in hotel function rooms. And it was a very lucrative circuit at the time. And it's just interesting to think that a Beatle parachuted into all of this and said, that's very interesting. Just press pause on the Hucklebuck there for a second. Here's Revolution. Burn it all. Let's go. And then he pulls himself out of there.
It's insane. I mean, it is absolutely nuts.
Yeah, I didn't. It's extraordinary to find that out.
But the good news is that the Great Southern Hotel has the John Lennon suite.
Oh.
I don't know what the room rates are, but you can get there on the 440 bus route from Westport or the 52 bus Air and Gold Liner.
I think we're getting to a level of detail in this podcast that people just don't want.
People will want to go and see.
It might be cheaper than the Montreal Hilton, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, the upside of this is after their long weekend away is that they come back in on June 25th, scrap those stereo mixes and do another set. So obviously, maybe it was Tony Chambers said, John, you need to pan that bass a little bit better.
Yeah. But the really fantastic thing is that these are the only people
who've heard that.
Who've heard this mix.
That is true.
So this is an absolutely unique mix that this acetate, where is that acetate now? I mean, you know,
they break, they disappear, they wear out.
So these are the only people that have heard that mix. That's a fantastic thing. All joking aside, that would be a fantastic claim to fame.
So we're here almost a month in after recording. It's June 25th. They mix off Revolution 1. Revolution 9 is coming into play. But this is where we might need to take a break, because we're going to look at the rest of Revolution in part two of this podcast, because we still have to talk about Revolution 9, the Revolution B-side, and what it all means once it hits the streets. I think that's a good place to leave it, don't you think so?
I think so, and we've secured our sponsorship from the Irish Tourist Board, so...
Yes, get to the Great Southern in Mulroney. So that's what we'll be talking about next week on the second half of our podcast discussion about the Beatles song Revolution. Thank you very much again for listening to us. We're available to get in touch with in all the usual places, on Twitter at BeatlesPod, on the private Twitter or private Facebook group that Stephen is the moderator of. He'll let you in there. And wherever you download your podcasts, if you feel like leaving us a nice review, that's always appreciated. So thank you very much. But until the next time, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.